At Ability Chiropractic, they do things differently. They believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Their doctors take time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, they help you restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
At Ability Chiropractic, we do things differently. We believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Our doctors take the time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, we help restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book an appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
With the state of today's economy, it's more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made from the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back in your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality, made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Down that rabbit hole, so reality is questionable. Try, but you just can't let it go. These two right here put on a show. It's paranormal overload with southern hospitality. Haunted murder mayhem tip while discussing immortality. Locations with a dark past, history that comes to life. Hillbillies with a knack for everything that goes bump at night. Overthinking if you're by yourself, these two will have you turning on the lights. Mixing in a little comedy to make sure it all fits in just right. Hey.
Welcome to Hillbilly Horror Stories. Now here's your hosts, Jerry and Tracy Paul, and their dog Ninja.
And sometimes their cat Freddy, but never the ferrets.
Hi, this is Dave Schrader from the Ghosts of Devil's Perch on Travel Channel and Discovery Plus, and you're listening to Hillbilly Horror Stories.
Hey guys, welcome to episode 360 of Hillbilly Horror Stories. I'm Jerry.
And I'm Tracy.
Tracy, we are excited to be back this week. I've got what I think is an awesome set of stories to talk about.
Very good.
We have a special guest on, neurosurgeon, Dr. Gary Simmons.
Great.
And we have a fantastic conversation to share with you guys on this. So we talk about a little bit of everything.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to talk about his book, Death's Pale Flag.
Okay.
Fantastic book. I've got a copy of it sitting right beside us.
Nice.
All right. First, we want to thank all of our military and civil servants all over the world, no matter which country you represent. Thanks to all you men, women, and service animals for everything you do for us on a daily basis.
Yes. God bless you guys. Always in our prayers. Thank you for keeping us safe. We love you all.
And we always like to use that as a lead-in to let people know that if you're struggling right now, no matter what the reasons are, just know that you've got people who care about you. Don't ever feel like that you're alone in whatever battle you're fighting. You always have help, whether you realize it or not. And if you don't feel like you've got immediate family or friends that can help you, we have a group with about 6,000 people that I'll guarantee will be there for you anytime, night or day.
Always. That group is phenomenal. They're a blessing, and I'm so proud of every one of you guys that always reach out to help one another. You can also call Jerry or I. We can give you our phone numbers, or you can call the crisis hotline at 988, or you can text 741-741, but there's always going to be somebody here for you.
Absolutely. All right, Tracy, since we are so close to Appalachia, and I know I get into this every time, Appalachia, Appalachia, everybody pronounces it different. It mm-hmm. just depends on what part you're from.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to say Appalachia because that's what I'm used to saying. Some even say that Lexington is part of Appalachia. I don't know that I necessarily count Lexington as part of it, but I still thought it would be cool to tell some eyewitness accounts and some horrifying experiences in Appalachia.
I never knew that. They thought Lexington was part of that.
I've seen people include Nashville.
No way.
As part of it.
Wow. That's interesting. I never knew that.
Yeah. So, I don't know. Let's learn a little bit. You know, I said Appalachia, but we're going to talk more about the Appalachian Trail.
Oh, cool.
So, we're going to learn a little bit about that first.
All right. You got to go you got to go down the trail before you can get there, right?
Yes. And that trail's a hell of a trail. The Appalachian Trail is 2,200 miles, and it goes from Springer Mountain, Georgia, to Katahdin, Maine. I'm sure I butchered that, but that's what it is. It goes through 14 different states, the Appalachian Trail.
Yeah, well, I didn't know that. That's a long trail to be hiking down.
It's the longest hiking-only trail in the entire world. So how about that?
I just think, I wonder if anybody's ever done that.
Yeah, there's been several people done it.
Oh, have?
Yeah.
Like for 2,200 miles?
Yeah. It's been open since 1937. It's part of the Triple Crown of hiking. The other two are the Pacific Crest Trail and the Continental Divide Trail.
Well, bless her hearts.
Only 1,186 people have hiked the entire trail.
Dude, that is way more than I thought.
Yeah, because you didn't think anybody did it.
No, I really didn't. That's a daggone long way.
I don't know who's got time to do that.
Who does?
Well, I don't remember if I wrote it down in here or if I just saw it somewhere, but it actually takes like several months, obviously, for most people to do it. So it's not something that just happens.
Well, kudos to them. I think that's amazing. I would have been done after a mile.
Yeah, well, I mean, when you think about it, it's actually a pretty miraculous feat when you take into consideration the rugged terrain and the unpredictable weather.
Yeah. Because
you're going through a lot of states with some bad weather mm-hmm. at certain times of the year.
That's pretty amazing.
But if you believe the legends out there, Tracy, there might just be a little more to the Appalachian Trail than you bargained for if you go hiking.
Oh, that's why I don't do that kind of stuff.
Well, let's think about, and this is where I was saying earlier, the Bell Witch is actually listed as an Appalachian story, and the Bell Witch is right outside of Nashville.
Oh.
I just would not have thought of that part of Tennessee being, you know, the eastern part, yes. The western part, no, but I don't
know. What do we know?
I don't know my geography that well, but that's... That's just the way that it is. The Bell Witch is actually listed. You've also got the Brown Mountain Lights. These are some strobing-type lights that are in the North Carolina, the Blue Ridge Mountain area, and they date all the way back to the 1890s before there were a lot of cars and stuff out on the freeway. So,
oh, you mean that people saw strobing lights?
Yeah, it's in the sky in the mountains.
And so way before cars were...
They had cars, but not enough to where there were freeways and stuff like that where you would see a lot of cars in the mountains.
Ooh.
Not the lights, anyway. And of course, you've got the Mothman, the Flatwoods Monsters in West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all part of it.
He don't venture out much, does he?
No, he likes to stay there.
Yeah.
He's found a home. He likes it. But today, I want to focus on some of the other types of stories that didn't involve the big name sightings like some of the ones we've talked about. I want to talk about some stuff that maybe you hadn't heard of. So, Tracy, not every horror story involves the paranormal. And the first story that I'm going to tell you about is one of those. It's more of a true crime, but it's crazy.
Hmm.
I think it's crazy.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Interesting.
It starts on the Appalachian Trail on May 19th, 1981.
That's great year.
What happened in 81?
I graduated.
Oh.
Yeah, you. God, that was so long ago. Ugh.
Well, that day, besides being the time you graduated. That's when Robert Mumford Jr. and Laura Susan Ramsey, they came from Maine down to Virginia, and they were going to hike a portion of the trail. This was supposed to be meant to be a fundraiser for a school that was ran by Mumford's mother for children with developmental disabilities.
Very nice.
So very worthy cause.
Mm-hmm.
Mumford and Ramsey were both 27 years old at the time, and they were both social workers. So the night that they arrived and started the hike, they met a fellow walking by the name of Randall Lee Smith. Now, if you've ever been to these along the trail, they have certain what they call shelters.
Mm-hmm.
So they are basically just wooden open buildings, kind of like you'll see at a lot of parks and stuff where yeah. they're just covered up and have picnic tables and stuff. They're basically like that. So if there happens to be some rain or something like that, you can kind of get out of the rain.
Okay.
Well,
so, that's awesome.
But they're open, basically. Right, it's not like right. it's a house with a door or something like that. Not like a homeless shelter or something mm-hmm. like that. It's just something to kind of get you out of the weather. So this night, they had dinner with this Randall Lee Smith that they met on a trail at what they call the Wampit Shelter, and that's in Giles, Virginia. But after dinner, there was going to be no dessert.
Well, that's a ripoff, especially if you eat all your dinner.
That's because after the dinner, Smith pulled out a .22 caliber pistol and shot Mumford, and then he beat and stabbed Ramsey to death with an iron railroad tie spike.
What is his problem? Why'd he do that for?
I have no idea. He then dragged the bodies to their site, put them in their sleeping bags, and buried them in a shallow grave. And this was right there at the shelter. It's not like they were very far away.
Oh, my gosh. How horrible.
Less than 2 weeks later, the bodies were found. Now, authorities found blood at the shelter, a camera with no film, and a book. Now, this book they thought belonged to Ramsey, and it was going to be the key piece of evidence to break this case wide open. Why, you ask? Because there was a bloody fingerprint on it. A print belonging to Randall Lee Smith.
Mmm. Sucker.
Police get a warrant. They search his home. And they find a pair of bloody jeans and some other evidence that made it obvious that he's the one that committed the crime. Matter of fact, the bloody jeans belonged to either one of the couples. I don't know which one it belonged to.
Ooh.
It was one of their jeans.
Oh, he took the jeans home with him?
Yeah.
Oh, he didn't put them on, did he?
I don't know that he put it on. I don't know if it was a Silence of the Lambs thing.
Good
I don't
grief.
Know if it was, don't you hurt my dog, bitch, or any of that. I don't know if any of that was involved whatsoever.
Oh, my gosh, how horrible. Well, I'm glad they caught him.
Police finally caught up to Smith. He wasn't home when they did the search and found all the stuff. They caught up in him in Myrtle Beach and arrested him. Of course, he claimed to have, I say of course, like this is what everybody says, he claimed to have amnesia.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't know how he even got to South Carolina.
I'll be dang.
Crazy.
Yep.
He was extradited back to Virginia for trial, but at that time, all he said was he didn't want to talk about the murders. Now, all of a sudden, it wasn't that he didn't remember. It's just
he just didn't want to talk about it. Not in mood.
Prosecutor was afraid that they weren't going to have enough evidence to get a conviction because they had no motive.
What?
I mean, you got
the hell?
What motive do you need if you've got some people?
Was
just
that
don't
his
have a
fingerprint
motive.
On the?
They got his fingerprint. They've got
what a bunch
bloody
of idiots.
Evidence at his house. But anyway, they felt like they wasn't going to have enough motive to be able to get him, so they got the family to agree to allow them to offer a plea bargain. Smith agreed to plead guilty on 2 counts of second degree murder. And he was given a 30-year sentence, but he only served 15 and was released in 1996.
Well, that doesn't shock me.
Well, here's where it gets even more strange. In jail, he was a model prisoner, and after his release, he appeared to be a model citizen, at least for the first 12 years. In 2008, a neighbor called police to do a welfare check, because they said that they hadn't seen Smith for several days. They thought something might have bad have happened to him. Well, the Giles County Sheriff Department came out and they did a search of his house. All of his utilities had been shut off for non-payment. Everything else seemed to be in order. It was just like he just up and left for no reason, basically. Well, friends knew that he loved nature and the solitude of the Appalachian Trail. So they just assumed maybe he just took off on an extended camping trip or something. But after he failed to arrive home, after several more days, a search party was called together. Now we're going to jump to May 8th, 2008. And this is just, a couple weeks after the search party was put out on him. Sean Farmer and Scott Johnson, their best friends, they were out camping and fishing at a place called Walnut Flats in Dismal Creek, Virginia. Johnston was out fishing by himself. He was approached by a man named Ricky Williams. Johnson felt that the man was lying, though. I don't know what it was about it that made him feel that way, but something rubbed him, you know, the wrong way, apparently. He described this man as a scraggly man that looked like he had been living in the woods for quite some time. But he had on an expensive camouflage coat and new hiking boots, which confused him. They more or less thought of him as, I guess, basically harmless, but they figured he was probably just an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. He gave across that vibe. The two men, Smith and Johnson, I mean, not the, because the other buddy hadn't shown up yet, but this guy who was really Smith, him and Johnson, they caught a bunch of fish together. So Johnson invited him back to their camp for dinner. And everything was going great. They ate. They were having some fun. After dinner, they were sitting around the campfire and started listening to some music.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was good. But as it started to get dark, Smith stood up between the two friends. He called for his dog, which he had brought along with him, and they began walking away from the campsite. That's when Smith pulled out his .22 and he shot both men. Farmer was shot in the left side of the face.
Mm.
Now, he was a big man, 6'4", 325 pounds. He kind of staggered a bit, but he didn't fall down. He watched as he shot at his friend Johnston. Johnston, after being shot, ran towards some trees behind the tent. Now, Johnson would later tell reporters that he took off running as soon as he heard the first shot. He never even saw the weapon. In fact, he didn't even realize that he had been shot until he stopped to catch his breath. That's when he found a hole in his neck.
Oh my gosh.
And he plugged it with his finger, his index finger.
Mm.
Just imagine, put your finger up in a hole in your neck or your throat. So now the dog has set off the haunted doll. So let me stop that real quick. So he's got this finger in his throat or his neck. He looks back at the campsite and he watches Smith shoot Farmer again, this time in the chest from about 10 feet away. Remember, he shot him in the face earlier. Farmer still did not go down. I think this guy's got some Michael Myers in him or something.
Oh, shit. I think I would just went down and been done with it so he wouldn't shoot me no more.
Now, Farmer has now been shot twice. He made a run for his car while Smith took off following him. Farmer gets in his Jeep and he starts down towards the main road. Johnson sees what's happening and he starts making his way towards the Jeep. This is when he realized that he had also been shot in the back. So he had been shot twice also.
Oh, and he didn't know
it? He didn't realize it.
Oh.
I mean, a .22 is not that big of a caliber weapon to where it's going to do as much damage as, you know, a .38 or something a little bigger.
I guess his fear was so magnified that he just didn't realize that
he'd
been shot.
Yeah, his adrenaline was probably pumping. So keep in mind, he's now running for the Jeep while holding his finger in a hole in his neck. Farmer picks up Johnston, and this is where it gets crazy, as if that wasn't crazy enough. So now Johnston's in the Jeep. They're 40 miles from the nearest hospital.
Mm-hmm.
They're driving 45 miles an hour, which doesn't seem like too fast, but it's down a treacherous, windy road with no guardrails and steep drop-offs in the dark.
Oh, gosh. Oh, my Lord.
And they're both
wounded.
Wounded, yeah. And sadly, the guy driving is the one that's been shot in the face and shot in the chest, but he's the one driving. Anyways, it was going surprisingly well until Farmer started to lose his vision. And then Johnson had to take control of the wheel, instructing Farmer when to hit the gas and when to hit the brakes. So he's driving from the passenger side. So you got Farmer, who's been shot twice, working the brakes and the gas, while his Johnson's on the passenger side working the wheel as they're going down treacherous roads with drop-offs and no guardrails.
That is insane.
They eventually get to the bottom of the mountain where they see five houses. They park in the front of the first home. Johnson goes up and he starts beating on the door, begging for help. So get this, the owner, Melissa Millie, she almost didn't open the door. But, by sheer coincidence, she recognized Farmer in the driver's seat as an ex-boyfriend of one of her best friends.
Oh, no way.
Police and ambulances were called. The two men were stat-flighted to the hospital. Johnson flatlined for a short time on the flight, but in the end, both men survived the attack.
Wow.
It turns out the bullet that struck Farmer in the face got lodged in his sinus cavity, and the one that entered between two ribs in his chest hit some muscle mass, and it actually pushed the bullet away from his heart.
Jeez, boy, somebody was looking out for him.
Smith fled the scene in Johnston's Ford Ranger pickup, but he was spotted by a Virginia State Trooper, and he ensued chase. Smith crashed during the chase, overturning the truck. He was taken to the hospital and was charged with two counts of attempted murder. He was transferred to New River Regional Jail Medical Unit, and he would later suffer a blood clot and die. And they think the blood clot was from the accident. He was 54 years old.
Karma's a bitch.
So how about that for a crazy
story?
That's
crazy. That is crazy. I'm just so fascinated that they drove down that mountain like they did.
I mean, it's, every part of that story was absolutely crazy.
Yeah, it was. Well.
All right.
I'm glad they didn't die, though.
Now, let's get into a little more of what we normally talk about.
Yeah.
Some craziness. So, Tracy, these next stories come from a forest ranger. I guess we should say park ranger. I think that's the technical term these days.
Yeah.
All right. Well, the park ranger goes by Stormy, which is fitting since that's what it's doing here now.
Yes, exactly. I hear it thundering out there.
All right. She had been at three different national parks over 10 years, but she spent most of her time at the Appalachian Trail. Stormy says that she had some crazy experiences while she was on the job. Nothing paranormal, but strange to say the least. One time, she found a severed human hand stuck to a tree. I'll do the sound effects, Lily. She finds this hand completely cut off.
Oh my gosh.
Stuck to a tree. She's out patrolling a more remote trail, so it's kind of off in the distance. It's not one that you got a lot of people venturing on. She sees something kind of glistening in the sunlight, so she pulls over. She then realizes that it was a human hand that was held to the tree by a knife. It stuck right through the palm. But that's not all. Each of the fingers had also been nailed to the tree. The hand was not going anywhere, trust me.
Apparently not.
Stormy was freaked out, as you can imagine, and she called her superiors, who in turn called the police. The area was searched, but there were no clues as to who the hand belonged to or why it was there to begin with.
So I guess if the nails were through the fingertips, then they couldn't get a good fingerprint.
I didn't mean fingerprint,
but you know what I'm saying.
I didn't think about that, but that's probably the case. They said it was very clean cut, and there was absolutely no blood on the tree or on the ground. On top of that, the hand looked relatively fresh, like maybe it had been there less than 12 hours.
I cannot imagine seeing something like that.
I mean, it's crazy.
Yes. And like the person, whoever did it, like really thought about it. Like, okay, I don't want no blood dripping because, you know, they could test the blood.
Well, they can still test the DNA and stuff in the hand.
Well, that's true. That's true.
All right, so it gets crazier. 3 months later, it's summertime now, very hot, she said. Storm was doing routine patrol on another remote trail. She came upon something that she says to this day she still can't explain. 7 deer heads, all severed heads, lined up exactly 1 foot apart from each other, and all the heads were facing east, and they were all doe heads.
Was this some kind of witchcraft stuff, or?
I don't know. She said they were all fresh.
Oh, poor deer.
But again, no blood.
It's a vampire. He drank all their blood. That's what it is.
Also, the eyes and the tongues had been removed, and they were nowhere to be found. And they knew that because all the mouths were purposely held open, like pulled open.
What a sicko.
So, she does...
So, she says, yeah, I quit. I'm done. That's what I would have said.
She said there were no trauma to the heads of the or the skulls of the deer. So, they were obviously, you know, killed somewhere else. But they, you know, all 7 heads lined up, all facing the east, all exactly 1 foot apart from each other. She's creeped out, but she didn't bother to call anybody. She just figured some hunter has killed a bunch of deer, and for whatever reason, they cut the heads off, and they're just trying to purposely freak somebody out and say, oh, somebody comes by here, they're going to be like, what the hell?
Yeah.
So, she didn't call for backup this time. She gathered the heads up, and she moved them off a little bit further off into the tree line so they would just decompose, because that's what they'll eventually do. 2 weeks later, there was a huge windstorm. So Stormy was sent back to that exact same area to make sure that there wouldn't damage to the trail. They wanted to make sure there wouldn't like trees and stuff on the trail that could be a safety issue because it's a state park.
Well, I see, but I think I would request not those trails that are way off in the distance somewhere.
Well, if you're out in the wilderness, they're all going to be for a certain part off in a distance. So she gets to this part where the deer heads were, and all the heads that she'd kind of moved off to the side, they were all gone. Now, it's possible that predators took them off, but not likely all of them, just 2 weeks' time. There was no trace of them whatsoever. But that wasn't the strange part. The strange part is she felt like that she was being watched. Mm-hmm. The entire time that she was out there.
Oh, my gosh. I would never, ever just do that. I just would not. If that ain't enough to tell you I'm not going to go camping anymore, I don't know what does.
Well, she said she also felt like something was really, really wrong, but she had a job to do. So after a few hours of working and cleaning up some brush off the path, she got the hell out of there. Once she left the area, she said that feeling subsided of something going wrong. Now, we're going to fast forward a few months later. It's October. The leaves were beautiful, the weather was cooling down. It's a great time to be a park ranger. They assigned her to another remote trail.
I think they're doing that on purpose.
That had some debris that needed to be removed. 30 to 40 feet off the trail, completely visible, was a stump. Resting next to this stump was the carcass of a dog.
Oh.
A large dog. She said maybe a Great Dane or a Mastiff. She couldn't tell because it had decomposed some, but it didn't look like any physical harm had been done to the dog. It's as if it just
fell over and died.
Fell over there and died. Now, she says she isn't sure why the dog passed, but what was really odd was the state of the dog's decomposition. The dog was in the open, but almost mummified. In the woods where the dog was found, there are a lot of flies, maggots, and other insects and animals that would usually start eating away at a dead carcass almost immediately. But that wasn't the case here. This dog had obviously been dead for a while, but it was still completely intact. And here's the weirdest part. In the dog's mouth was a folded up piece of paper. The paper looked really old, maybe a few months old. It was clearly weathered. But Stormy unfolded the neatly folded up piece of paper, and it said, written in very crude handwriting in black ink, eventually we all turn to dust.
What?
Stormy was thoroughly confused what this meant or even how in the hell it got into the dog's mouth, but there it was.
She's a brave woman. So I would be saying, dude, you need to send somebody down there with me. That's too much for one person to handle. That is so weird.
Well, but this is three stories over a 10-year period.
Well, that's true, but still, after the first one, I would have been done. I mean, kind of looking no hand stuck to the tree.
Here's our last story of the night. And this one actually isn't Stormy's, but it comes from Stormy's friend. So Stormy tells the story. There was another ranger on the Appalachian Trail. This goes back to 2011. Now, this park ranger had a terrifying experience with what she described as a bipedal wolf.
What's a bipedal?
2 feet, 2 legs.
Oh, a wolf?
Yes.
Hmm.
Or Sasquatch or Dogman or
yeah.
something of that nature. So the ranger was actually part of a search and rescue of a hiker that was later found, so that's good news. But the ranger just happened to be in the area where the hiker went missing when they started the search. She was by herself, on foot, and it was nightfall. She was about 3.5 miles from the ranger station if you followed the trail.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Of course, you know trails aren't exactly straight.
No, not at all.
She cut through the forest to cut down the length of the trip. She had a great sense of direction and great awareness, and she would make this trip now about 1 mile instead of over 3 miles. So, yay for her. This shortcut is through a little-known game trail. Things kind of start to begin to feel off to her. The feeling in her body, she described as fight or flight mode,
wow.
suddenly hit her. She felt she was being hunted by a mountain lion, so she tried to make it through the woods as quick as possible. But some of the brush was growing up way more than she expected, severely slowing her down. The terrain was way tougher than she had remembered as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not good when you're being tracked by a large predator. She gets about 1/2 mile into this game trail, and she could still hear something following her. She stops now since it's a lot slower, and she starts focusing more on listening.
Yeah.
She says now it sounds like whatever it is that's stalking her sounds like it's on 2 legs and not 4. She starts listening even more intently, and she realizes that whatever this animal is being sneaky. The animal was quickly closing in the distance between it and her. It got close enough that she fired a warning shot at it. Now, apparently this pissed off the creature. What she felt was a mountain lion turned out to be much worse. The creature emerged from the woods, not completely clearly where she could see all of it, but enough so she could see that it was no mountain lion. She described it as a bipedal timber wolf. It looked like a person in a wolf costume or a timber wolf that was comfortable walking on 2 legs.
Oh, God. I mean, when she's doing this, I mean, can she radio back to the station and say, hey, something's following me, I need help?
I'm assuming she had some kind of
walkie-talkie. I wouldn't go out there without one. At least if you didn't have a gun, you could walkie-talkie them to death or something.
Right. Now, while a walking wolf is scary enough.
Hell yeah.
The intelligence in the animal's eyes is what truly made this ranger fear for her life. She said she looked it straight in the eye for 3 to 5 seconds. And she said, and when you look into an animal's eyes, you can sense kind of what's going on.
Yeah, but like with Freddy?
Yeah. She said, but when you look into a person's eyes, you can sense emotion and thoughts and mm-hmm. intelligence and consciousness. And that's what she got when she looked into the eyes of this animal. She understood that its only intent was to hurt her. That was clear with its body language. As she reached the end of the trail, she had to go around a large bend in the path. And she said this creature reached out and tried to grab her, but she shot it again, and she thinks she must have hit it because it let out a horrendous scream, unlike anything she had ever heard in her years and years of being in the forest. She was now able to make it all the way to the ranger station. She did not report this to any of her superiors.
Why not? What is wrong with these people?
Well, she was scared of being ridiculed. But she said, and she was never questioned about the two shots that she fired off.
So they heard the two shots.
I don't know if they heard it or not. She would have thought they would have heard it. It's only half a mile away.
Right.
Or that I'm assuming they probably checked their weapons and make sure that all the bullets are accounted for. But she said they'd never asked about it, and probably because they were in the middle of a search and rescue at the time. So.
Now. Yeah.
How about that for some creepy stories? So we got a little bit of paranormal, a little bit of strange and creepy with the deer head in the hands, and some true crime all on the Appalachian Trail.
That is so scary. I will never go there.
And we won't even get into the missing 411 stuff.
My gosh. That is really, it's unnerving. You know, it's like, and these women, I'm sorry, they're very brave to go out there by themselves. Even if there wasn't no kind of critter out there, whatever. Just being in the dark in the woods by yourself, to me, that's crazy. I would never do that.
100%.
Well, they're brave, and I hand it to them. That's some good stuff. But yeah, that would be a little bit much for me if I was in their shoes. I think I'd be done.
All right, let's take a quick sponsor break. We'll be back with a couple of updates, and then we'll listen to Dr. Gary Simmons.
Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, we help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Our doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true health starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at AbilityChiro.com. That's AbilityChiro.com.
Hey guys, finding the perfect gift for the food lover in your life is easy, thanks to Gold Belly. Gold Belly ships America's most iconic foods straight from world-famous restaurants right to your door. So if you want to treat someone to Joe's Stone Crab from Miami, Franklin Barbecue from Texas, or desserts from famous foodies like Ina Garten or Martha Stewart, Gold Belly has you covered with free shipping anywhere in the country. Just go to goldbelly.com and for a limited time, get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's promo code GIFT.
All right, Tracy, so let's talk about the events coming up, because Buffalo is only like 3 weeks away now.
It is. Buffalo!
Get your tickets, hillbillyhorrorstories.com, Us, Brohio, Justin Rimmel from Mysterious Circumstances, and Tyler Allen from Minds of Madness.
I'm excited. I can't wait.
Yes, it's going to be fun. We get to go to Niagara Falls. I've wanted to go forever.
Yeah, that's going to be fun. I'm not so excited about my hair getting wet, but, you know, I'll live.
You'll get over it.
I will. I'll get over it. It's a beautiful, and I want to see it so bad, so yeah, I can't wait.
Can't wait. And then right afterwards, I have to come back and have my surgery to put my defibrillator in.
Yep, we do.
Like 3 days later.
Mm.
So.
Yikes.
Technically, they wanted to do it beforehand, but that would put me out of commission for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, can't have that. So.
No, well.
I sacrificed for you guys. Come to the Buffalo show.
He really did.
Then we've got Detroit. Mm-hmm. Detroit's starting to catch on fire. People are starting to buy tickets left and right.
That is so wonderful.
Where did you guys see this place? It's a suburb of Detroit. It's not like Detroit. It's like 30 minutes from Detroit, but it's on a lake. The whole area is absolutely beautiful. Sarah set this up for us as far as finding the location, and she couldn't have done a better job.
Yeah. Thank you, Sarah. We appreciate you, doll.
So, and then we've got the Pigeon Forge show. I keep saying Pigeon Forge, but we changed it to Gatlinburg. We had to find a bigger location with Tony and the Confessionals. That's September 30th. That literally has, I think, 20 tickets left.
Wow.
That one will sell out. And it's amazing how quick tickets. It's 100 seats in there. We've sold 80 already, at least. Might be 81 or 82.
Wow. That's
so
exciting.
So that one's going to be sold out. And then,
before that,
September 2nd, which is,
Labor Day weekend.
The Bell Mansion, us, and Mysterious Circumstances, Justin Rimmel. You get to, not only your tickets will get you a tour, a meet and greet, a live show with the two of us, and
dun, da, da, da.
From 10 p.m. to 2 a.m., an investigation of the Bell Mansion. And, wait, there's more.
Wani na na.
Nobody gets that.
No.
We will choose one of the people who bought tickets to spend the night with us in the Bell Mansion.
So bring your pajamas.
And there's only 50 tickets available, and most people are bringing somebody. So there's probably going to be only 30 chances to win that thing.
Yeah, but there's a lot of people that's bought tickets for that, and we're very excited.
So we're going to we're gonna announce that a couple of weeks ahead of time. So
of course,
you'll
yeah.
know. Mm-hmm. I think Justin's going to go up to the mansion, and he and Amy are going to draw and make a live event out of it.
Oh,
and
cool.
draw the winner to spend the night.
Nice.
So if you definitely want to get your tickets sooner than later, because they're going to draw that like 2 weeks beforehand.
Uh-huh.
But I'm expecting it to sell out because we're about almost half gone now. So, all right. What else we got to talk about? You know, I should have mentioned this. We've got a friend, Jenny, that she makes the most incredible soaps.
Oh, my gosh.
And air fresheners. She makes air fresheners that, like, mine is the shape of a heart. It's probably an inch thick. And it's as big as a smaller telephone.
Yeah.
Cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, it's wax. It's got all kinds of cool stuff. I'll post a picture of it. I took some pictures later. I've had it in my car since we did the Indianapolis mm-hmm. show back in May.
Mm-hmm.
May 20th, I think that was. And it still smells great.
Oh my gosh, it does. It makes, honestly, why you want to eat it. I'm like, oh, it smells so good.
I don't know how it doesn't melt in the hot sun, but it doesn't.
I know. I don't know how that happens either, but it's beautiful. But she does great work.
I've never seen an air freshener that was made out of wax like that. It's awesome. She gave us some other soaps and some soap dish, and I actually sent her a message earlier because I want to order another air freshener because it's starting to lose a little bit. But hell, it's been two and a half months
yeah.
in the heat mm-hmm. for the most part. So she's going to eventually write me back. She's got some bad weather in her neck of the woods.
Yeah, they said, I saw on somewhere that they had, oh no, actually she said it, that there was a tornado where she was and that her car got pretty good hail damage, but they were okay.
Well, the name of the company is Honest Bees, B-E-E-S, skincare company. And like I said, soaps, air fresheners and all that. And they're cheap.
Chapstick.
Yeah,
I mean,
chapstick.
Yeah.
But she's got like it's $7 for the small air fresheners and $15 for the big ones. And I think the one I got is the big one.
Mm-hmm.
But $15 the last 3 months?
No, it's amazing. And they're so pretty. She does a wonderful job with them.
But she's on Facebook and Instagram and TikTok. Just look up Honest Bees Skincare. And like I said, she's not paying us anything. She has no clue I was even doing this
until tonight.
No.
I'm and sure honestly, she's probably...
yeah, honestly, I should have done this before then. Because she was nice enough and gave us a bunch of stuff. And it's great.
Mm-hmm.
And we should be promoting her.
Absolutely.
So, I'm excited about it. All right. Tracy, what do you got going on over there?
All right. Well, we had a lot of iTunes reviews this week. Thank you guys so, so much. Kayla Ventries, she actually commented on your Amanda's new show, Wickedly Weird. And she loves it. I'm glad you're all back. So, thank you, Kayla, for that. And we have Young, 2128, Jason B., Susan A. Bowman, Ruth Dempsey, Can't Think of a Name, and Mojo Lobster.
There you go.
Well, that's all right. Thank you, guys. We appreciate you guys so much. Those reviews mean the world to us, and it helps us, too. And we just want to say thank you for taking the time to do it. You guys are the best.
And Tracy mentioned our new show, Wickedly Weird, with Jerry and Amanda. Thank you guys so much. You guys have been super nice. It's gotten more listens than I thought it would have been, and we've got a bunch of nice reviews so far. I've not had anybody have anything negative to say about it. And a lot of positives. And if you haven't listened yet, there's only 3 episodes up, but it'll give you a good idea of what it is. It's a lot like we do with Macabre Misfortunes mm-hmm. on Saturday, but they're just all crazy stories that have crazy endings.
Right, right.
So it's a bunch of twists and stuff like that. And like I said, you just get, she doesn't know the story, just like Tracy doesn't. So it's just honest reaction. They're short episodes. They're like 20 to 30 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they're more PG.
Yeah, than, they're not as crude.
Yeah, they're not rated XXXRX like the old ones. Matter of fact, I just recently took down all the old episodes.
Did you really?
Yes, I took them all down except that the only thing up right now is the Wickedly Weird episode.
How come you took them down?
Because I'm going to put them up on, I think I'm going to do a Patreon. That'll be a free Patreon, mm-hmm. but I'll put all of them up there if people just want to go listen. But I wanted to separate them so people didn't go and listen to one. And say, well, I thought this was going to be.
Yeah, well, that makes sense.
Yeah, because trust me, there's no comparison between the two when it comes to vulgarity.
Oh, well,
and I didn't want to turn some people off.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll put them up so people can still find them if they want them and they won't have to pay for them.
Oh, perfect.
But I wanted to just have this feed strictly for Wickedly Weird now that people were. Listen.
What did you say?
Wicked something like Wickedly Weird. So also, that's a big thought. Now let's listen to Dr. Gary Simmons. I think you guys are really going to like this one. We don't ever get a chance to get a brain surgeon on.
No.
So it's pretty cool.
We'd probably be a good study.
his thought process is very cool on some of the stuff we talked about. And he told me off the air that he really liked the questions I asked him. He thought they were outside the box. And, you know, so.
Very good.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't ask him, like, if he'd ever tried to make a Frankenstein monster or nothing. That would have been cool. But, you know, you ever take anybody's brain out and just put it in a thing of formaldehyde, not tell the family? You ever do that? I didn't ask him nothing like that. I thought that could have been rude.
Well, I hope not.
It could have been rude and a turnoff to a guest. So, all right, guys, listen to Dr. Simmons. You know, guys, I constantly have to tell our listeners when they're like, you know, how do you come up with so many stories and when you put so many episodes out a week? And I tell them all the time, look, it's not like it's brain surgery. Well, I can say that on my job. My next guest can't technically say that because his day job is brain surgery. And I've got Dr. Gary Simmons on. He is a neurosurgeon, but he's also an author. And we're going to talk about his book today, Death's Pale Flag. Dr. Simmons, thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much. This is truly an honor.
Well, I would say it's more an honor on my end because it's the first time that I think I've ever talked to a neurosurgeon. So I'm excited about having somebody of your caliber on the show.
I think it's always good to keep your interactions with neurosurgeons down to a minimum.
I would agree. You know, I guess I technically back in the day, and you probably, since we're doing video on our end, you probably have already picked up on this doing what you do. But back about 17 years ago, I had a really bad case of Bell's palsy that never cured. So my left side of my face is still partially paralyzed. And like I said, most people will try to say I wouldn't have known if you hadn't told me. Trust me. It's the first thing I notice on somebody because of my situation. So you've probably picked up on it because you deal with stuff like that on a regular basis. So I guess technically I did deal with some neurosurgeons back in the day, but we didn't have to go that far with actually doing the surgery or anything.
Yeah, no, I would say until you mentioned it, I hadn't locked in on it. But I think it's like, you know, if you buy a certain car, all of a sudden you notice all the other cars on the road are the same, right?
Yeah, I think I heard sometime that was called scotoma or something like that, where you all of a sudden notice something that's been brought to your attention, but you didn't notice it before. And I could have completely made that term up, but I'm pretty sure I heard that was the term at one point.
Yeah, well, as far as I know, unfortunately, it's scotoma usually refers to spots before your eyes, but maybe somebody else has a different definition. I don't know.
See, that just goes to show you can't believe everything that somebody on the street tells you. All right. So let's talk about while you're here. You are obviously, you know, a doctor, a neurosurgeon, but you're also an author. And I want to talk about kind of what got you to write the book. So let's go back before we talk about the book itself. Let's go back to some history. You had a Scottish grandmother that used to constantly tell you like ghost stories and stuff. And you had some of this going on with your mother who believed in obviously ghosts and the phenomenon. And I think this kind of piqued your interest and probably got you on the path to where you're at now, where you write books that involve that type of stuff. Let's go back. Tell us some stuff about your grandmother from Scotland.
I think my grandmother lived in our house where I grew up, which was New Jersey of all places. And then for a few years in England as well. But she constantly spoke of ghosts being around the neighborhood, being around the house, being around her upbringing. But unfortunately, most of the time, I think as I got a little older, I just dismissed her as being a little on the loony side, whereas my mother was as sharp as a tack. My grandmother gave me other reasons to believe she was a bit on the loony side, but my mother was always sharp as a tack, and she firmly believed and had multiple experiences of her own. I could relate, kind of one of my favorites, if you wish.
Sure.
One of my favorite stories of her, when she was born and her early years were in Edinburgh, Scotland, but her family moved down eventually to England. Her father managed a pub in a English seaside town, and they lived in the pub. It was also an inn, so they lived in a couple of the rooms in the inn. And my mother started noticing when they moved into the pub, she started noticing weird things happening in her room not every night, but with some frequency, like the bed being raised, drawers of her dresser opening and closing, the door opening and closing, footsteps, but particularly messing with the bed, again, lifting the end or shifting it one way or the other. Anyway, she started complaining about it to my grandparents, and she complained enough that they started looking into it, wondered if there were trains coming by at a certain hour, or buses or that sort of thing, and never found any good explanation until they called the former owner and of the pub. And the former owner said, well, what room is she in? And they said something like room 23, whatever it was. And the owner said, well, of course, room 23 has always been haunted. And, kind of typical for the British, I think they were like, oh, well, that explains it. Go back to your room. And she continued to grow up in her haunted room. So she was definitely a firm believer from early on.
It's funny that you say fairly typical for the British, because I've got a lot of British friends, a lot of British podcasters, and they don't look at the paranormal the way that Americans do. It's just kind of a ho-hum thing to them. And, it's the British podcasters that I know that talk about the paranormal, 85% of their listener base is from America. So they have a hard time getting a listener base in their home country because it's just not that big a deal over there.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's by a large segment of the population is accepted, is just the way it is. And here we have to have, scientific proof and ghost busting and all that sort of thing to prove it yes or no. But yeah, we lived in England for a few years when I was a kid, and I would say the same thing goes. Practically every other house had a ghost, or had some horror story from back 200 years ago, and the place still had echoes of the past in it.
Tell me a little bit about how your day-to-day activities as a neurosurgeon prompted you to come up with an idea for this first novel.
Well, the novel kind of, like, I guess a lot of things came from a lot of directions, but I've through the years, through the last 15 years or so, had a lot of interest in the whole idea of burnout. and burnout and psychological distress, particularly in healthcare workers, because that's all I knew. I pretty much spent all my life in the hospital. But it's rife. There's a lot of people burning out, a lot of people really buckling under the strain. And so I had written other books about this subject, but when I started wanting to really kind of dig deeper and show readers what that world was like, what my world was like, and the burnout theme was going to enter into it anyway. But I started thinking about how it would be, I think, much more enlightening, much more immersive to have it as a fictional book, as a novel, as opposed to just kind of a didactic, here's what each day is like, here's what an operation is like. What I was really hoping to do is put people right there in the operating room or the ICU or the emergency room and have the patient bleeding to death in front of them. And, you know, your turn to do something. Well, anyway, again, I think, you know, multiple streams or multiple threads start getting woven into it. And this kind of history of being around the paranormal, the supernatural, with my family, or at least one half of my family, started weaving itself in there as well. And I started thinking, well, you know, we spend so much time in my business right there at the point of life and death. And I'm not trying to be over dramatic. It's just part of my specialty. I was thinking that, you know, we're there when many people cross over, and we're always there trying to pull people back. I mean, I've certainly brought people back from death, and I've certainly lost plenty of people. And so we're right there. And in the book, we talked about it. Even, you know, one of the characters talks about it almost like a bridge, that you're at the bridge between life and death. And I started playing around with the idea of, well, if somebody is there all the time, like the protagonist, who's a surgeon, of course, who is a brain surgeon, of course, but if you're there all the time, wouldn't it be somebody like that, that maybe the undead, maybe the spirits or the ghosts would be able to reach out to, would be closest, or they might even, you know, see somebody like that as being related somehow, or being more comfortable reaching out to. So that's kind of how that started entering into it, was, you know, if anybody is real close to the spirit world, it would be somebody who's right there when people are crossing over one direction or the other. And that allowed me to kind of really get into the fictional side, because I could talk about the brain surgery side till the cows come home. But I personally have not seen a ghost. I've had interactions that might be questionable, but I personally haven't seen one. But I thought, yeah, that would be a neat thing to explore, and then to, you know, question, is he truly experiencing ghosts? And what do the ghosts want with them? Or is he, you know, having a breakdown? Is his burnout going too far? And I thought that would be the fun thing to let the readers try to start deciding.
Really cool. Now, I'm gonna pin you down a little bit.
Okay.
A lot of times when I've talked to people that have medical degrees, science degrees, they have a hard time saying that they believe in the paranormal. Most of them don't. That's why I find it odd when I find someone with a science or medical degree that does believe in the paranormal. Where do you stand? You've heard the stories from your mother and your grandmother. You're writing books now that are based on it. What are your thoughts on what happens after a person does die?
Oh, great. Now I'm going to answer the biggest question in all of humankind, right?
Absolutely.
I've got the answer for you. No, I think it's an important question. And I think actually it's one of the reasons I wrote the book and one of the things I'm really interested in exploring with people. So another, you know, one of the reasons why I wrote the book, frankly, is I want to open up dialogue on several of the subjects that are in the book. I really want to talk to readers, you know, individually or in groups. So like on my website, I have all different ways to connect with me and all, but I'm not looking for fame or fortune, but I really do want to connect and discuss things like this. So with that as background, technically, I'm a neuroscientist, you know, my expertise, my world, a lot of my research, you know, it's all on how the brain works. And we have to study it all the way down to the, you know, the molecules involved in how nerves work and stuff. And, you know, you talk to many neuroscientists and they want to tell you that this is all generated by, you know, our nervous system, by the way our neurons connect with one another and how, you know, synapses form and all this sort of thing, how the nerves fire and communicate with one another. And somehow that all generates a consciousness. And we do know, you know, our brains are pretty capable of creating almost any sign, any scene, anything that you can see, smell, feel, touch, because all you have to do is think about your dreams. They can be exceedingly vivid, right? So, So, you know, there is a lot of people in the scientific realm, as you're saying, and a lot of people in the neuroscience world, particularly, I think, who are very skeptical. But I've always looked at the scientific side, you know, as being a little bit conceited or full of hubris or what. When we start coming off thinking we can answer everything, I think we are so far, far away from answering any of these questions. And I think we tend to think science does more than it can. I personally believe science is there to ask questions and to approximate as best we can the way things work. But it's only ever an approximation. It's always correcting itself as we go along. I think the real scientists will tell you, we never come with the absolute answer. We can kind of tell you things that it is more likely and less likely. And I think we shoot for predictability, but I think to really believe we have the answers, I do think that takes a lot of hubris. So that allows me to really be more interested and be able to think more and be more open to a different world, the world of the spirituality, the world of religion, the world of paranormal, if you will, or supernatural, because, you know, we try to describe the natural world, but, you know, that doesn't mean there isn't a supernatural. And I think it's particularly funny, sorry to babble on about it, but I think it's particularly funny, like if you look at what astrophysicists, as these top astrophysicists start discussing, and they talk about alternative universes, bless you, by the way, alternative universes where, you know, one element is a microsecond off the previous universe and yet everything else is the same. I don't know. I don't understand that stuff. But when you read it, I start going, my God, this isn't any different from having beliefs in paranormal or supernatural or that sort of thing. I do think we all make kind of leaps of faith. And I think if you believe science has everything, I think that's just as much as having a faith in something you can't prove as anything else. So that's a long-winded way, and forgive me again for babbling, but it's a long-winded way, I think, of saying, I just have an open mind. I don't know what the answer is. If a ghost presented he or she self him or herself to me tomorrow, I wouldn't be shocked. And so I think I am prepared to believe, and that's as far as I can take it.
All right. So now I have a follow-up question along those lines. Near-death experiences. You obviously are in situations to where people have probably possibly had a near-death experience on one of your tables, whether you found out about it or not.
Absolutely.
People, I hear a lot from the scientific community, from the medical community, that is not really a case of someone leaving their body and seeing what's going on. It's a case of your brain creating endorphins to help the situation. And you see what you see because the brain created endorphins. With that being said, it doesn't explain how some of these near-death experiencers can name the who all was in the room and the view from looking down, and actually in some cases traveling out of that room and going to a waiting room and seeing what was going on with, you know, people that were there waiting on the outcome of the surgery. What is your thought on people who claim to have had near-death experiences? Do you think it's the endorphin situation, or is it a mixture of things?
Yeah, interesting you ask that, because there's just been a flurry recently in the neuroscience literature about particularly, it's really based on one case, and then there's been a few more after that, but where an EEG was running right at the time of a patient's death, and they caught a whole bunch of brain activity right when the heart stopped. And they were saying that the brain activity is very similar to when you're very active in your brain and you're reading something or watching something. And they were hypothesizing that maybe this is a person seeing their life flash before their eyes or something like that. And trying to ascribe it again to this increased brain activity. And again, I kind of get this feeling that the scientists are trying to stretch and trying real hard to get at what you were just discussing, what you were just describing. Heck, we've got all these reports, report after report after report of people who've been through it, who say, I've had this experience, this out-of-body experience, this, you know, knowing the people in the room, knowing people in other rooms. And maybe it all just comes down to this burst of brain activity as a brain is beginning to die. So again, I get this feeling that we're the scientists of, in the equation are just too uncomfortable, you know, to be willing to grant that there may be something more going on than just a burst of electrical activity or neurotransmitters like the endorphins or anything like that. So again, I just keep an open mind to it. I don't think we in any way have an explanation for it on a scientific level.
So we are talking to neurosurgeon Dr. Gary Simmons about his book, Death's Pale Flag. Doctor, we're going to get back to the book in a second, but I've got other questions, because every time you say something, I don't get very many opportunities to talk to neurosurgeons. So now you've got me going down rabbit holes. So now we've talked about near-death experiences. It leads me to my next one, lucid dreaming and just out-of-body experiences. There are a lot of people that swear they have mastered the art of being able to leave their body and venture out and lucid dreaming. What are your thoughts on those two topics?
Well, that may be a rabbit hole too far, a bridge too far for me, because I'll have to make something up. I am not an expert in it. I was actually just with a really top level University neuroscience just a couple of weeks ago, a neuroscience professor just a couple of weeks ago. But I was saying to him, you know, we for the amount of time we spend in sleep, we do very little. There's very little real scientific knowledge of what the heck is going on or even why the heck it's going on. For me, I have not spent a lot of time studying the sleeping world. I find it really interesting, actually, and I think dreams are fascinating when you think about it. I know lucid dreaming is almost the idea of being able to control yourself in a dream and recognize that you're in a dream, but almost use the dream to, you know, as you say, extend beyond your person, if you will, with you kind of semi-controlling it at least. But I have no experience with that. I will say in the book, there is a fair amount of discussion about sleep pathologies. The main protagonist has night terrors, which is, you know, a form of what we would call a sleep pathology, where he wakes up in the middle of the night screaming and thrashing and screaming in utter terror, but doesn't remember at all what preceded it.
Well, I'm going to ask you a personal question, and feel free to say I don't want to talk about it, but you are someone that has to deal with death a lot, I'm sure, just over the years, not, you know, intentionally, obviously, but it's just something that it's part of the craft that you chose to do. How do you deal with actually losing somebody on the operating table? That's got to be something that, I mean, I'm sure it's a lot tougher in the earlier years, but is death something you become indifferent in just because of the career that you've chosen?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's probably, central to the nonfiction books I wrote, and a lot of the potential for burnout, I believe, revolves around that question. And certainly in the novel, I think that's one of the things getting at the heart of the main protagonist, is this near constant exposure to people dying. In the novel, but it comes from my own experience. I read an article several years ago in the New Yorker. It was about people who had killed other people, usually through car accidents, but through really no fault of their own. They weren't drinking. They weren't on their phones. It just happened. But they were devastated, absolutely devastated. And in my world, there's no question that we hurt. And I am sure hasten people's deaths, if not, you know, directly result in somebody's death in things that we do in the operating room, because a lot of these people truly are, you know, one foot in the grave and one on a banana peel, and the small errors can certainly push people over the edge, for sure. So one neurosurgeon once wrote, you know, every neurosurgeon has a graveyard of people they put in there, carries with them a graveyard that they put in there. Anyway, the point is that you deal with a fair amount of hurting people badly, even when you're trying to do good, and people, you know, dying that you're trying to save. And you have to harden yourself about it. There's no two ways about it. You can't, if you break down and you have another operation coming in right after it, you can't function. You can't do your job. And so you have to kind of harden your heart and move on. But it's there. And I think, for example, it gets into your dreams. I think it gets into just your whole version of the world. Your sense of humor turns very dark. And there's an interesting phenomena for me that I found, was that I think through most of my career, I rode through it pretty well, if you will. All that means is I closed it off, but I didn't break down. I wasn't constantly feeling depressed or anything like that. I just moved from one disaster to another, if you will. But I retired a couple of years ago from operating, and an interesting phenomena where I have become far more emotional than I ever was, where I'll just tear up on the certain movies when they are trying to make you tear up, but it never affected me in the past. And now, you know, things that are supposed to be heart touching are touching my heart much more than I would have expected. And heck, I'm sometimes watching a TV commercial and I'm tearing up and I'm going, geez, where did that come from? But I really think, you know, a lot of it is you've been suppressing your emotions for a long time and holding them back because you had to perform. And now I don't have to. They're coming to the surface a lot easier. And I do have a lot of dreams. And a very frequent dream is to be in the middle of an operation, having something horrible happening, bleeding everywhere or whatever, and nobody in the room trying to help or doing what I'm asking them to do, and me standing there screaming at everybody, you know, you've got to help, you got to help. I really think that's all kind of stuff that is the result of exactly what you're asking about. So I think people deal with it in many different ways. For me, I think it was suppression. We do see some really bad behaviors. I think some people turn into pricks, you know, they're just yelling and, you know, they're in the hospital. So you get that kind of stereotypic above everybody else surgeon who's yelling and barking orders and all that sort of thing. I think that's one of the responses. You get this self-denial overindulgence cycle that we talk about in our books, where people kind of weather through it, and then they get a break and they're out, you know, drinking too heavily or taking drugs or, you know, I don't know, all sorts of other very unhealthy indulgences. And if you ask them, why are you doing this? They'll say, because I earned it, kind of response. So I think many different types of responses, but I don't think you can run away from it completely. It's there.
You know, the thing that I always hated about the medical community in telling someone that they've lost a loved one is the terminology, because I can't tell you how many times somebody has come out and said, well, your husband has expired, like they're sour milk or something. And I just always hated that term, expired. It just doesn't come across well, I don't think, to most family members, even though the end result is the same and they're shocked. But I think afterwards, once they've had time to think about it, it's like, why would they say expired? It just seems like the coldest thing to possibly say, rather than passed on or whatever the situation, didn't make it. Expired just seems so, you know, nonchalant, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I it's another great point. I even though I stopped operating, I do a lot of teaching still with med students and undergrads. I do have some canned lectures, and one of my canned lectures is called Speak American. And it revolves around the idea of when we are delivering things like bad news or talking to patients in general, we often flip into some pretty bad language. The easiest one is to just flip into medicalese, where you just start talking in, you know, medical terms that, unless you went to medical school and residency, it's just not in your lexicon. But I think and just as you say, or we'll use these kind of really euphemistic terms that are either insulting or they don't really get to the heart of the matter. And I think some of it goes back to what you were asking before. I think some of it is protecting our own feelings. And I don't think consciously, but I think, you know, being around death, being around tragedy, being around all these horrible things, I can tell you, I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about, oh, what if this happens to me? But I can sure as hell tell you, I spent a lot of time thinking, oh my God, this could happen to my wife, or this could happen to my sons. And I think we retreat into this bad language sometimes, almost out of a sense of vulnerability. Much easier to you know, kind of come in and say, well, you know, your loved one has a acute subdural hematoma, and you know, we're going to do this, that, and this. And you kind of just keep that dividing line there where we're above it all, as opposed to, you know, really just saying it plainly so that it's very understandable, very digestible, and then feeling the feelings it engenders when you can see it hits the target, that the people are like, oh my God, I've just lost a loved one.
Yeah. And that definitely makes sense on both sides. I mean, I get it. It's just frustrating if you're on the other side getting the
Absolutely.
Bad news.
No, I agree. I think we have to do a better job.
We're on with Dr. Gary Simmons. The book is Death's Pale Flag. That thing has gotten so many great reviews. I've got the book here at the house. People know from the show, I'm not much of a reader. I read out of necessity. I'm about 2/3 through it. Absolutely love it. I can't recommend it enough. Just the fact that I read any of it is a recommendation in itself. And anybody listening can tell you that, because it takes a lot to keep my attention. But tell everybody how they can get the book, Dr. Simmons, where they can find it, and how they can keep up with you as an author.
Yeah, the book is going to be out there on June 27th is the actual official release date. And it'll be out in all the major online venues, you know, where you can buy books. I'm still working on trying to get it into various bookshops, which is always somewhat of a challenge. But it's definitely going to be on the main sources for books, both independent bookseller sources and then the typical Amazons and Barnes and Nobles and things like that. I'm on all the typical social media, but I do have my own website that's just my name, Gary R. Simmons. It's actually Simmons, but I pronounce it Simmons for spelling's sake. But GaryRSimmons.com, and so it's easy to get on that way, where you can easily connect with me via email or text, and I'd be really delighted to discuss, you know, any of these issues with you all. And there's so many that we can talk about: death and dying, the spirituality versus science, paranormal, burnout, giving bad news. Another thing that I really tried to underscore in the book there, Jerry, and by the way, there an audio book is coming out. It's probably going to be a few more weeks, but there is an audio book version as well. But another thing I tried to get out in the book was the notion of just how remarkably brave and full of grace so many patients and their families are. I think, you know, we live in this time right now where we as Americans seem to be at each other's throats. What I certainly noticed through decades of working with people is, you know, when we are pushed to the wall, when we are in periods of great stress and duress, we revert to our better selves. And I can't tell you just how inspiring it was to be around so many people in the worst moments of their lives. I always thought to myself, oh my God, if this was happening to me, I'd be screaming and throwing things and breaking things. And these people are just, they're just, as I said, so full of grace. So you talk about another, I don't know, it seems almost supernatural how calm and collected and graceful and thankful and all that so many of our patients and their families have been. It really is a tremendous inspiration. I did want to tell you about drifting back away from the book and back to the paranormal side. My mother had another great story. She had many, but she was a young woman in World War II. And first thing, she used to go to seances, and at the seances, they would the medium, I guess it's called, would give lists of people who were going to be killed locally in the war. And she said they would often come true, which I always thought was kind of chilling. But at one of these seances, the medium told her that she had a guardian angel. My mother had a guardian angel. And my mother, throughout her life, kind of sensed that somebody was there trying to help her. But at one point, she was at a movie theater during World War II. And the air raid sirens went off, and they always said, stay where you were. Don't go outside because, you know, there's flying material and stuff that could injure you. And she heard, you know, somehow some voice telling her to get out of the movie theater. So she ran out of the movie theater, and it was later hit by a bomb with most of the people in it killed.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, you know, you hear stories like that. It's hard to be a complete disbeliever.
No, I agree. And it's like the famous Winston Churchill story where he had told the chefs to put his food up. He wasn't going to eat it right then. And then he got everybody out of the way. And then the place was actually struck by a bomb. And that area where he would have been, you know, was completely just obliterated. So,
yeah, it's crazy what they went through, for sure. Closest I ever came, this is not a nice story for you, after the video there, just seeing, but as I said, my mother and my sisters always wanted to do the Ouija board. Now, my father was completely on the other side of the divide, and he would make fun of us or try to scare us when we were doing it. But the closest I think I ever came to some sort of supernatural experience was the Ouija board one day started saying to kill the cat. We had a cat, and it said, you know, kill the cat. And we're like, well, that's not nice. And it was a day or two later that, you know, I came home and everybody was crying, and the cat had been run over by a car. So,
oh goodness.
That
yeah, sometimes those Ouija boards.
So, well, I stayed away from them from that point on, to be honest.
Well, Dr. Simmons, it has been an absolute blast having you on. I wish you nothing but success with the book. And I will urge everybody to go to your bookstores and online, wherever you can possibly find a book and get it. I'm sure you're going to absolutely love it as much as I do.
Well, I am so beholden to you for helping me put it out there and for actually reading it. I think I'm very honored. Well, and I hope you do enjoy it. It's got a controversial ending, so you'll have to tell me what you think when you get to that.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Simmons.
All right. Thank you so much.
See, how fun was he?
He is. He's so interesting. And just, I think it's so cool to be a brain surgeon. I mean, think about this. Honestly, when you would first do your brain surgery, like your first one, how nervous would you be?
I would imagine you'd be pretty nervous. I mean, but it's probably that way for every doctor.
Oh, I'm sure. But the
for
brain.
Every surgeon, I should say.
Yeah. That's amazing. But he's a very interesting person. Very nice.
I loved his outlook on a lot of things. So, And the book is fantastic. If you like that kind of thing, if you're into that kind of thing, like I said, I've read the book, and I don't read very many books, but I found it very fascinating. And it's got some Beatles stuff in it.
Oh, what?
So, yep.
Dang. Good.
All right, guys. Thank you so much. We love you. We'll talk to you later.
Have a blessed week.
At Ability Chiropractic, we do things differently. We believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Our doctors take the time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, we help restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book an appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
Hey guys, have you heard of Goldbelly? It's this amazing site where they ship the most iconic, famous foods from restaurants across the country, anywhere, nationwide. I've never found a more perfect gift than food. Goldbelly ships Chicago deep dish pizza, New York bagels, Maine lobster rolls, and even Ina Garten's famous cakes. So, if you're looking for a gift for the food lover in your life, head to goldbelly.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's goldbelly.com, promo code GIFT.
Hey guys, finding the perfect gift for the food lover in your life is easy, thanks to Goldbelly. Goldbelly ships America's most iconic foods straight from world-famous restaurants right to your door. So if you want to treat someone to Joe's Stone Crab from Miami, Franklin Barbecue from Texas, or desserts from famous foodies like Ina Garten or Martha Stewart, Goldbelly has you covered with free shipping anywhere in the country. Just go to goldbelly.com and for a limited time, get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's promo code GIFT.
Hey guys, have you heard of Goldbelly? It's this amazing site where they ship the most iconic, famous foods from restaurants across the country, anywhere, nationwide. I've never found a more perfect gift than food. Goldbelly ships Chicago deep dish pizza, New York bagels, Maine lobster rolls, and even Ina Garten's famous cakes. So, if you're looking for a gift for the food lover in your life, head to goldbelly.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's goldbelly.com, promo code GIFT.
Hey guys, finding the perfect gift for the food lover in your life is easy, thanks to Goldbelly. Goldbelly ships America's most iconic foods straight from world-famous restaurants right to your door. So if you want to treat someone to Joe's Stone Crab from Miami, Franklin Barbecue from Texas, or desserts from famous foodies like Ina Garten or Martha Stewart, Goldbelly has you covered with free shipping anywhere in the country. Just go to goldbelly.com and for a limited time, get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's promo code GIFT.
Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, we help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Our doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true health starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com. That's abilitychiro.com.